administrators is really the bottom line, really being federal funds coming into these colleges and universities. Is that what's going to drive the policy on the campus itself?
That's exactly right. And holding over dean's head the threat of loss of federal funding if he or she doesn't crack down on campus organizing.
This is KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. We're going to go ahead and let Between the Lines finish out.
Duke and the University of North Carolina for hosting a symposium about the Israeli blockaded Gaza Strip. Congressmen from Virginia just filed a complaint with the Department of Education against Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. for allowing scholars on campus to criticize Israel. This is the extent to which there is this huge crackdown because, you know what? Israel and its supporters, they have just simply lost the debate. They cannot debate Israel's claims on its own merits. So it's all about suppressing the debate from happening and suppressing the organizing from happening, because where students are organizing, they're doing so very effectively. And on dozens of campuses across the country, we've seen student governments agree with Palestine rights organizers that universities should divest their funds from corporations that are profiting from Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people.
That was Josh Rubner, senior principal at Progress Up Consulting and author of Israel, Democracy or Apartheid State. Find more perspectives on President Trump's December 11th executive order to combat anti-Semitism by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPPM in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KODX in Seattle, Washington, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
KZFR presents in Chico a New Year's Eve blowout. It's Tuesday, December 31st at the Chico Women's Club, starring three great local bands, Swamp's End, Smokey the Groove, and Lo and Behold. Get tickets online at kzfr.org, Chico Paper Company, and Blazin' Jays. This is a low-dough show. Tickets only $10 in advance. The New Year's Eve blowout is at the Chico Women's Club. Don't miss it. Beer from Sierra Nevada.
Welcome to show 1951, the December 18th, 2019 episode of Non-Human Radio, a roundup of current news on animal issues, focusing on animal agriculture, animal rights, and veganism. I'm your host, Jeannie Trezino, and I'm here every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. here on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico. You can listen to us streaming and archived at kzfr.org. Non-Human Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Ohm Foods, serving organic, non-GMO whole foods, including wild-caught mahi-mahi, and having the largest vegan menu in downtown Chico. Ohm Foods serves homemade teas and lemonade, acai bowls and smoothies blended with coconut water, and you can find them at 142 Broadway, just two blocks from Chico State. They're open Monday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. with to-go and catering available. For more info, you can find them at iloveomfoods.com and, of course, on Facebook. And we're also made possible by Peterson Tree Care, because trees need care. John Peterson continues his family tradition of caring for Chico's amazing natural resource. Licensed, bonded, and insured with financing available, Peterson Tree Care handles residential and commercial properties and can be reached by calling 518-0924. All right. On today's show, we'll be covering a few news stories, leading with the Wild Animal Initiative, which focuses on the welfare of wild, free-roaming animals, followed by good news for ravens in Oregon, followed by a summary of innovative research that expands ecological diversity research to include non-native species. Our last story is on the professionalization and accreditation of companion animal welfare within a university system in southern Utah. Time permitting, we'll end with the Chico Vegan Calendar of Events. All right, let's get right to it. Our first news piece is an article published on December 10th on the Sentient Media website, which is a nonprofit online news organization reporting from the intersection of animal and human lives on animal agriculture, animal rights, and other areas. The animal protection movement has traditionally focused on reducing suffering on factory farms and in laboratories. Now, advocates are entering the wild to fight animal suffering in creatures' natural habitats. A koala named Ellenborough Lewis captured the heart of the internet. Millions of supporters from around the globe were cheering for Ellenborough, hoping that he would recover from life-threatening burns sustained in a forest fire in Australia. A woman surrounded by flames in the midst of the Australian bushfires rescued the koala using the shirt off her back, literally. 2 weeks later, the viral video of his rescue helped to garner more than $1 million in donations for the hospital, the koala hospital treating Ellenborough. Sadly, Ellenborough's burns were so severe that he had to be euthanized. The hospital, which was the Port Macquarie Koala Hospital, had launched a GoFundMe page last month in hopes of raising, their goal was $25,000 to help treat Ellenborough and all the other koalas that had been affected by the ongoing fires. They actually ended up exceeding that goal and raising more than $1.7 million. That was fortunate for them. Anyway, to carry on. Nature can be brutal for wild animals who are afflicted by extreme weather conditions like the Australian bushfires and much more. A new animal protection movement posits that humans can and should systematically reduce the suffering of wild animals. Most people are familiar with efforts to improve the lives of shelter pets and animals in factory farms, yet few people have heard of the wild animal welfare movement. The population of free-roaming animals dramatically exceeds the number of animals living in factory farms, in labs, or as companions. But humans pay little attention to the well-being of wild animals. Wild animal welfare advocates believe that humans can best help wild animals by identifying the sources of suffering in the wild and implementing solutions that eliminate them, or at least reduce them. The Wild Animal Initiative, WAI, established in early 2019, is perhaps the only organization devoted exclusively to wild animal welfare. According to WAI Executive Director Michelle Graham, the vision for the movement is to enable, quote, as many animals as possible to live as good lives as possible. According to Graham, advances in research biology, including the ability to develop more sophisticated biological models, now make it possible to discover more about what life in the wild is really like. With WAI in its infancy, Graham and her counterparts primarily focus on learning and research to determine the viability of different interventions and predict unintended outcomes. Graham believes that humans have the capacity to improve life in the wild, or at least stop making life worse for the creatures who do live there. Some elements of wild animal welfare work and traditional conservation efforts overlap, but these two fields serve distinct purposes. Wild animal welfare workers focus exclusively on reducing the suffering of free-roaming animals. Conservationists generally aim to maintain or increase specific animal populations, often focusing on endangered species. consider the situation of the Florida manatee. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission changed the status of manatees from endangered to threatened in 2017, which conservationists celebrated as a victory. According to the Dolphin Research Center, however, 85% of Florida manatees have scarring on their backs from boat collisions. Harm to manatees from boat collisions has not decreased, even as the manatee population has stabilized. Human-caused manatee suffering needlessly persists, and so this becomes an issue for the wild animal welfare movement. It's not just enough that the population of an endangered species has been has recovered enough to become a more threatened species. They are also looking at the quality of life of that animal. And clearly, boat scarring indicates some severe pain and recovery on a repeated basis of these really gentle creatures. The wild animal welfare movement seeks to address the myriad of unanswered questions about wild animal suffering. Researchers are exploring the many causes of suffering and death in the wild, and also seek to understand whether animals, wild and domesticated, experience suffering similarly to humans. Once researchers determine a potentially viable intervention to reduce wild animal suffering, they examine possible repercussions. Interventions may increase the target species population, which can in turn modify ecosystems and food webs in ways that are, of course, difficult to predict. The WAI, the Wild Animal Initiative, has launched a program to reduce the suffering of wild birds by educating new cat owners. Research suggests that global bird populations have been devastated by outdoor cat predation. Cats are predators who will kill not just for food, but also for mental stimulation. Cats cause birds to suffer by inflicting injuries that permanently maim or lead to protracted, painful deaths. And as an aside, if your outdoor cat has ever brought home a bird to you and that bird seems to be okay, if that bird has been in the cat's mouth, it has taken in a dose of infectious bacteria that will eventually kill that bird if it doesn't get assistance. So call our local Bidwell Wildlife Rehab and let them know the situation. Keep the bird in a box. Don't try to feed it or anything, and get it to into proper care quickly. To continue, the WAI cat predation program aims to protect birds from injuries and grisly deaths by encouraging cat owners to keep their companions indoors where they are also safer. The WAI hopes that by educating the public about how outdoor cats harm birds and other species, it can significantly decrease wild animal suffering. The cat predation program represents an intersection between wild animal conservation and welfare work. The program's success will both increase bird populations and improve birds' quality of life, as well as the cat's quality of life, but that is not their aim. The Wild Animal Initiative's project to reduce cat predation represents a broader effort to include wild animal welfare in the animal protection movement. Advocates hope that research and careful interventions can earn free-roaming animals more human attention and reduce their suffering. By including wild animals in the broader animal protection movement, a kinder world for all beings is possible. And that was an article entitled Wild Animal Welfare Movement Takes Shape Worldwide by Julie Knopp, published in the December 10th, 2019 online website sentientmedia.org. You're listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio hosted by Jeannie Trezino. If you want to follow more current events and animal rights-related news, I invite you to follow the Non-Human Radio Facebook page. Our second news story is a news release dated December 17th, that's just yesterday, from Portland Audubon of the Audubon Society about a dramatic example of compassionate conservation relating to a proposed cull of ravens in the state of Oregon. The article starts out, this morning, Portland Audubon received the news that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife have canceled a proposal to kill hundreds of ravens in Baker County in northeastern Oregon. Portland Audubon has led a coalition of groups opposed to this proposal. The agencies had argued that killing ravens was necessary to protect declining greater sage-grouse populations in Baker County. While Portland Audubon is deeply concerned about sage-grouse declines, the proposal was inhumane and not supported by science. And that is related, you know, to the earlier story about the Wild Animal Initiative. That word inhumane, that is not accidental. That is very intentional. The environmental assessment put forward by the agencies included no data demonstrating that ravens were actually preying on sage-grouse nests, would have left hundreds of eggs baited with poison scattered across the landscape, and would have left nestling ravens whose parents were poisoned to starve in their nests. The proposal also ignored significant causes of sage-grouse decline in Baker County, such as an off-road vehicle area that was developed in core sage-grouse habitat. And if you're not familiar with what a sage-grouse is, it is a chicken-like bird that is mostly living on the ground, but can fly really, really well with strong wings. And they are... they feed on sage, and they live in just a very desolate part of our environment, in mostly high desert conditions where there's just sagebrush and pinyon pine. Just a very hardy species, but requires big areas to survive. More information on the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife plan. They had proposed to kill adult ravens during nesting season using chicken eggs laced with a poison. The poison is slow-acting, and the birds typically die from renal failure a few days after ingestion. Because ravens often cache their food, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife admitted that it expected only one out of every four poisoned chicken eggs taken by ravens to actually be consumed by them. This means that to reach their target of 500 dead ravens per season, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife would have needed to observe ravens taking at least 2,000 poisoned eggs from their bait stations. Of these, they had predicted that 1,500 eggs would be left scattered across the landscape for non-target wildlife to consume. So this just sounds on its face like, how could they propose a system like this if ravens are a threat, which they weren't able to substantiate? Then how does this type of haphazard system actually help sage-grouse? Good for Portland Audubon, good for its partner groups, which included the Humane Society of the United States. The press release continued on saying, in conveying the decision to cancel the proposed killing in 2020, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife cited many of the issues raised by Portland Audubon and its allies. The agency acknowledged that more science and research was needed, non-lethal strategies should get additional consideration, and that they agreed with Portland Audubon and other groups that leaving young ravens to starve in nests was not acceptable. The agencies will take another year to conduct research on the impacts of ravens on sage-grouse in Baker County and to consider a broader suite of strategies to address sage-grouse recovery. It is possible that they will return in future years with a revised proposal that includes killing ravens, but for 2020, that killing that was supposed to begin in the coming months is no longer moving forward. Portland Audubon will continue to monitor the situation closely and to work with the agencies to develop humane, ecologically responsible strategies that truly address the primary causes of sage-grouse declines. Yeah, additionally, the agencies had no pre-study data on the sage-grouse nesting success. They had no baseline with which to compare their this horrible protocol. Good job, Portland Audubon. Good job. I don't even know what to say. Just agencies can sometimes come to very bad conclusions, and thankfully they were responsive to public demand. Thankfully there was a group looking at it. Right? This action was not governed internally by the government agencies themselves. They were promoted to a decision by an external nonprofit. This is the way civic action, civic responsibility works. All right. Our next news piece is an article summarizing research by wildlife biologists looking at the metrics of non-native species in relation to whole ecosystems, which is published on December 11th by the Anthropocene Magazine website. The article begins, "How would biodiversity look if we counted non-native animals? When conservationists measure a locale's biodiversity, it's typically the native animals who matter. Creatures whose ancestors arrived during the last few centuries or escaped from human captivity are not treated as though they belong. But what if those non-native and feral animals are regarded, at least for the purpose of tabulating species, as legitimate members of their ecological communities? The researchers wrote that, quote, currently conservation data is filtered through a value system that considers, quote, native life the only appropriate subject of conservation concern. Our team examined how trends in species richness, distribution, and threats change when all wildlife is counted. The researchers were led by ecologists Ariane Wallach and Daniel Ramp, both of the University of Technology at Sydney, Australia, and who are also so-called compassionate conservationists, which is a movement of scientists, conservationists, and ethicists who argue that the moral value of each individual animal's life deserves more attention in discussions traditionally framed in species and population level terms. One implication of that perspective is open-mindedness towards critiques of what they call nativity or nativeness as intrinsically good and non-nativity as likely bad, with the latter having little ecological value and frequently being killed to promote desired native species. Nativism filters the most fundamental empirical information available to conservation, species counts. This research team examined what might be revealed if biodiversity datasets were fully inclusive. The researchers focused on vertebrate species whose forebears were imported into Australia by European colonists and their descendants, such as dromedary camels, African wild donkeys, and tilapia fish from Mozambique, or also those animals that were taken from Australia into new locales, as with a frog called the growling grass frog and the laughing kookaburra, which is a type of bird. They identified 87 immigrant species, that's incoming, quote, non-native species, and 47 emigrant species, those species that became non-native to wherever they landed at. Then the researchers reviewed scientific literature, online databases, and government reports, ultimately estimating how much of each species' population and habitat now occurs outside of historical ranges. Some interesting trends emerged. For species who, quote, immigrated into Australia, not a perfect term since unlike human immigrants, those animals had no choice in the matter, an average of 30% of their global range is now non-native. For those who emigrated, that non-native range is around 7%. One-third of immigrant species and one-quarter of immigrants are threatened or decreasing within their native ranges. For instance, the African wild donkey and growling grass frogs, for example, are both endangered in their native ranges, and the donkeys critically so in their native ranges, and yet they are thriving or countable, or at least countable, outside those ranges. The conservation community could come to regard threatened migrants as refugees to be harbored rather than invaders to be targeted, write Wallach and colleagues in their paper. Meanwhile, some 52 more species have immigrated into Australia than have gone extinct there since colonial times, a trend that certainly doesn't offset the tragedy of extinction, but does make it possible to conceive of Australia ecologies in a different way, as not simply depleted, but persisted and even flourishing with a slightly changed cast of species. This is, of course, sure to be controversial, and you may be, it may be controversial in your own mind right now. But it is at least, according to these authors, a conversation worth having. The team found that formal conservation accounts can underestimate species' global distributions, that migrant populations can provide a safeguard for species threatened in their native ranges, and that they can increase local species richness even where extinction rates are high. Inclusive conservation data can change our understanding of the living world. And that was from an article entitled, How Would Biodiversity Look If We Counted Non-Native Animals? Published on December 11th, 2019 on the website of the Anthropocene Magazine at anthropocenemagazine.org by nature writer Brendan Keem. You've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio hosted by Jeannie Trezino. Our final news story is on a new college-level certificate program in how to run a no-kill shelter at Southern Utah University in Kanab, Utah. The article begins, starting in January 2020, students at Southern Utah University can sign up and get 6 credits for learning how to run an animal shelter in the university's new certificate program. It's part of an expanding partnership with the Best Friends Animal Society near Kanab that will now include coursework in how to set up a haven for cats and dogs and how to operate it in a humane, no-kill way. quote, what this program represents to us today is that we are training and teaching a whole new generation of people who want to get into the field of animal welfare and want to do it the right way, said Julie Castle, executive director at Best Friends, at a news conference announcing the certificate program. The Society's goal is to have all shelters in the United States be no-kill by 2025. Having started in the 1980s, the Best Friends Shelter is now the largest such haven in the United States. The program at Southern Utah University will be comprised of mostly online classes taught by professionals and animal keepers from Best Friends. Students will study how to reduce the killing of companion animals in shelters and how to create and run their own shelters where they are. The certificate is specifically offered online so that students anywhere nationwide can sign up for the courses. Southern Utah University spokesperson David Bishop said that Texas and California, for example, have more shelter kills than any other states, a total of 225,000 killed animals in 2018, so it might be of particular interest to individuals in those states. Students will also visit the CANAB shelter one or more times to see how it works and participate in an annual conference there during the six-month program. The credits earned will translate to a certificate in executive leadership, but can also count towards any bachelor's or master's degree at the university, particularly those in business, public administration, and interdisciplinary studies. The hope is to spread the idea of no-kill shelters nationwide and professionalize the industry, Best Friends Executive Director Julie Castle said. Only one other university in the nation, the University of the Pacific in Stockton, offers a similar program. And that was an article titled Southern Utah University to Teach Students How to Run a No-Kill Animal Shelter from the December 10th edition of the Salt Lake Tribune by Courtney Tanner on a new program that is yet another step in the professionalization of the animal welfare system in the United States. You've been listening to Animal News on Non-Human Radio, and now it is time for the Chico Vegan and Animal Rights Calendar of Events. December 19th, tomorrow, I just want to point out, at 5 p.m., Safe Space Winter Shelter Volunteer Coordinators meeting will be held at Black Bear Chico for a sign-up party. Any questions or concerns that folks might have who are interested in volunteering for Safe Space this season will be answered by volunteer coordinators. Safe Space sheltering begins on December 22nd and will continue through March 14th. Please go to safespacechico.org for more information. And remember, if you have a roof, be grateful. Coming up on December 21st, the Winter Whatever pop-up will be featuring vegan pot pies by Near and Dear Vegan Baked Goods at Blackbird Chico on Saturday, December 21st from 6 to 8 p.m. For more information, you can call Blackbird Chico at 433-1577. And coming up on Sunday, December 22nd, join Bieber Almond Milk for the opening of their new store with a holiday pop-up celebration and vegan French toast served up by Near and Dear Vegan Baked Goods. For more information, please see the Bieber Facebook events, which I have incorporated into the Non-Human Radio Facebook page, or at their website, freshalmondmilk.com. As always, we have one last piece of business to close out today's show. Our quote of the week is from the novel Middlemarch by Marianne Evans, a.k.a. George Eliot, about the small kindnesses and sacrifices that we all make. Quote, the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs, end quote. Clearly, we must do more hidden kindnesses and unhistoric acts for each other and with each other. What's on your plates or what you wear on your backs are good places to start. This has been Non-Human Radio, a production of KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of KZFR, its board, its volunteers, its underwriters, or its staff. Our theme music, which we'll play shortly, is Ready to Fall by Vegan Activist Rockers Rise Against. Please stay tuned for The Real Issue with guest host Chris Nelson at 6 o'clock. She'll be interviewing Jim Broback from Aqua Alliance on water issues in the North State. Have a great week, and thanks for listening. This is Jeannie Trezina signing off.